Donald Hoffman is Professor of Cognitive Science at University of California, Irvine. He is one of the world's leading thinkers in the area of consciousness, with his interface theory of perception, as well as a mathematical model that assigns numbers to consciousness akin to physics. He received his PhD in 1983 from MIT. An initial starting point, even though it's quite a mundane one, but still fundamental in terms of definition, is generally before we get to some of your work in terms of the interface theory of perception and modeling consciousness in a way that we could do similarly to quantum physics, how would you, just as a primary tool, define consciousness in itself?
Consciousness, intuitively, is the everyday awareness we have of simple things like the smell of garlic or the taste of chocolate or the sound of a trumpet or the feel of a tickle. All the various sensory experiences that we have are the fundamental aspects of what I call, you know, conscious experiences. There are more high-level aspects, for example, self-awareness, being aware of myself as a perceiving entity. But I think that the interesting problems of consciousness come far earlier, even in just the taste of chocolate, something that we might expect a rat to do. So I think the interesting problems of consciousness are already there in much simpler organisms that may not have any notion of self-awareness, and yet they're having conscious experiences. So I think that we have to take those kinds of experiences quite seriously and try to understand them from a scientific perspective. And then as well, consciousness is not just a passive thing. We act. So I have this notion of conscious agents, so that we don't just have conscious experiences, but we then make decisions based on what we experience. For example, I experience in front of me, a rotten apple and a ripe apple. I have a decision to make. And then once I make the decision, I act. And in some cases, I might choose to take the ripe apple as opposed to the rotten apple. So consciousness involves perception, decision, and action. All part of what I would call a conscious agent. So this is sort of similar to the kind of point of view that people have when they talk about embodied cognition or an active, although where I differ from many of them is I do countenance computational structures going on, information processing, as a way of describing this. I think that not all, but the radical embodied cognitive scientists would deny that there's anything for information processing to do. And I think that that's a mistake. But I do think the idea that perception doesn't happen in a void, and that we have to think about it in terms of decisions and actions all working together, I think is critical to understanding what it means to be conscious.
And with that, obviously, your model tends to be an all-encompassing model. So, for example, when you describe perception, decision-making, and action, that would lead itself to, obviously, primary studies in neuroscience in terms of how we get states of mind from neurons. I know that's, you see that as a controversial issue, but, I mean, your work covers that as well, but it'd also cover areas of cognitive psychology in terms of ideas, motivations, and how that also leads to actions.
Yes. So I do have a mathematically precise formalism for what I call conscious agents. And it's an abstract structure, just like in the theory of computation, the notion of a Turing machine is a formal structure that's used as a model for any potential computation. And so I also propose the conscious agent. I may be wrong, but at least I'm trying to be precise here, where I have a precise model that I call a conscious agent, and then I have a very precise and bold claim, which, again, is probably wrong, but you've got, that's the way science works. And the claim is that every aspect of conscious experiences and every aspect of human cognition can be modeled with interacting systems of conscious agents. So it's a very precise formalism and a very bold claim. And the point of the precision and the boldness is not because I'm sure I'm right. I'm almost sure I'm not. But it's to be scientifically precise so that I and others can try to find out what's the problem with this approach and then fix it. And that's how science progresses.
No, I mean, that's completely fine. I think most people would at least applaud the fact that even though your model might be inaccurate in certain respects, at least you're trying to mathematically define something. And as long as you define something, we've got a starting point, which is good. The issues that come up for you in consciousness, I'm assuming that you do see qualia as being something real, that you see the hard problem as being something real, because you get certain reductivist philosophers of mine, such as Dan Dennett, Patricia Churchland, that come to the almost lackadaisical conclusion that qualia is part of folk psychology, and that it's not really anything what it's like for Tony to be like Tony or a bat to be like a bat. Consciousness is an illusion, and it's something that comes out of the materialist brain, and it's just basically a little smokescreen show going on inside an actual physical box. Someone like David Chalmers would say that the hard problem really is a problem. And how do you stand on the aspect of qualia in general?
Well, so I would be much closer to Chalmers on that than Dennett or Pat Churchland. I think that, you know, it's quite possible that I know nothing, that everything I believe is false. But if anything I believe is true, my belief that I have experiences, that I have a headache, that I smell garlic, that I feel a tickle, that I can feel the, you know, the feeling of velvet, if I'm wrong about those experiences as experiences, then I'm probably not right about anything. And in particular, I'm not right about physicalism. How do I come to the belief that there is an apple that really exists in front of me? I come to that belief because I have experiences that I describe as a red apple with a 3D shape and so forth. If those experiences are entirely illusory and to be dismissed, then so is physicalism. So I think that you dismiss conscious experiences at the peril of dismissing all of physicalism. Now, my own take is that physicalism itself has deep, deep problems that come from taking the theory of evolution by natural selection quite seriously.
There's also a philosopher of mine called Philip Goff, who's basically advocated a panpsychist approach to consciousness because of the problems that you face ontologically and epistemologically from trying to get consciousness out of a physical world. You touched upon the problems of evolution, and one of your notable works is obviously the interface theory of perception. So essentially, I mean, you make the analogy to an icon on your desktop which represents a file, but really that's not the actual file in itself. It's just a set of microbytes in a digital file in a computer, but you know it represents your textual file, but it's the shorthand of an interface. And obviously that's how you see a lot of the world relating to each other,
right?
And from an evolutionary perspective, obviously you say, and many others do as well, that to survive and to have successful traits and to pass it on as genes, that it's not really about representing or understanding reality correctly, but only in a means that will serve your propagation of genes in the fittest and most efficient way.
Mm-hmm.
So clearly, I think that the point from that, and I'll let you expand on that point more, but the point from that is that, yes, you need to see reality at a certain correct level, but not an ultimate correct level. So you only need an aspect of probability for it to be true, not for it to be true in itself. And I mean, you make this many points with animals mating in the world and how they're basically fooled by different images of what they think are mates, but there's something else.
Yes.
So expand on how this all relates to reality and how consciousness is used to perceive or the world around the human mind.
Yes. So the issue that I looked at was that, you know, the hard problem of consciousness comes about because we take physical objects as really existing. Neurons in the brain really exist, we assume, in space and time, whether or not they're perceived. And so we take that as our fundamental ontology of the world. And that ontology is really grounded in the belief that our perceptual systems, which show us a world of 3D and objects and colors and so forth, we're assuming that they're veridical, that they report accurately, not exhaustively, but we think that they report accurately what we need to know about the objective world in order to survive. So this is the standard view among vision scientists and anybody who thinks that brain activity, you know, causes our conscious experiences. They're basically assuming that space and time are objective, and physical objects like neurons and apples and rocks exist even if they're not perceived. And the reason they believe that is because they believe that evolution has shaped our perceptions to be, you know, roughly accurate most of the time. Not exhaustively, no one believes that, but roughly accurate. And the argument that is given is actually psychologically quite compelling. The argument goes, those of our ancestors who saw more accurately had a competitive advantage compared to those who saw less accurately, and so they were more likely to pass on their genes that coded for those accurate perceptions. So after thousands of generations of this, we can be pretty confident that we're the offspring of those who saw more accurately. And so our perceptions are accurate, though not exhaustively true. And that seems a compelling argument, and if it were true, it would ground the belief that space and time and physical objects really are the nature of reality, independent of any observer. But I began to question that about 10 years ago. I wondered, well, you know, evolution is a mathematically precise theory. We have evolutionary game theory, evolutionary graph theory, genetic algorithms. We don't have to hand wave with intuitions about what we think evolution might do to perception. We can do some tough scientific work. We can run simulations and even try to prove theorems. And so I went to work with my graduate students doing that. We first started off with simulations, hundreds of thousands, I think approached the millions of randomly chosen worlds where we put resources and fitness functions in those worlds and have organisms that could see all of the truth in those worlds, some of the truth or none of the truth, and some of the ones that saw none of the truth, we let them just see the fitness functions. They were their perceptions were tuned to the fitness payoffs. And what we found in the simulations was that organisms that saw the truth invariably went extinct when they competed against organisms of equal complexity that didn't see any of the truth and were just tuned to the fitness payoffs. And even when the organisms that were just tuned to fitness payoffs and saw no truth were considerably simpler than the organisms that saw the truth, they still beat out the truth. They still won. So that gave me some confidence that maybe you know, evolution by natural selection does not favor vertical perceptions. In fact, it goes out of its way to drive them extinct. And so I conjectured a theorem and have a mathematical colleague, Chetan Prakash, and he proved it. So it's a theorem that if our perceptual systems evolved by natural selection, the probability that any of our perceptions, that even the language of our perceptions, space and time and shapes and colors, that language is the right language to describe objective reality is zero. So it's not simply that we get this or that perception or that idea about the world wrong. It's that the very language of our perceptual systems is simply the wrong language to describe objective reality. And that's the desktop metaphor that you mentioned, I think, is a way to help understand this, right? If you look at your desktop and you're writing an email, and the desktop of your computer has the, you know, an icon for that email that's blue and rectangular, and in the middle of your desktop, that doesn't mean that the file itself in the computer is blue or rectangular or in the middle of the computer. I mean, anybody who thought that just really misunderstands the whole point of the desktop. The point of the desktop is not to show you the truth of the computer, the diodes and resistors and voltages and so forth. It's there to hide that truth completely and to just give you eye candy to let you get done what you need to get done. You interact with the reality of the computer entirely ignorant about the nature of that reality, because even the predicates of the desktop, you know, colored shapes on a two-dimensional surface with maybe pixels, that's simply the wrong language to describe the innards of a computer. If I was a computer science professor teaching a class and I said, I want you to give a description of how a computer works, but you can only use the language of pixels on a desktop, well, good luck. You just have the wrong language. They can't do it. And that's the point. Evolution gave us an interface with predicates of space and time and objects and colors, and it's there explicitly to hide the truth, not to show us the truth. It's there to hide the truth, and it's even the wrong language to describe the truth. So that then places this whole issue of consciousness in a very, very different context, and that's why I pursued this issue of evolution and perception, because, you know, I like everybody else was trained as a physicalist, and I bought physicalism. The problem was I couldn't solve this consciousness issue, the hard problem of consciousness, and that bothered me. And so when we have a problem that's actually been around for centuries or millennia, and we're still spinning around in the same old circles, it's time to question assumptions. And so that's why I began to question, you know, unthinkable questions that, you know, hypotheses that would be unthinkable to question, namely, do we see reality as it is? And so the bottom line is, if we evolved by natural selection, if our perceptual systems evolved by natural selection, then it's a theorem of that theory that the chance that we see reality as it is in whole or in part is zero. And that then means that neurons don't exist unperceived. That changes the whole hard problem. If neurons don't exist unperceived, then neurons cannot be the basis for our conscious experiences. And that throws out 99.9% of all the work that's been done on consciousness.
If I could just unpack some of those issues there. So, for example, the shorthand aspect of reality, which is the metaphor and the analogy comparison to the desktop, that's fine. And obviously, our file isn't actually a piece of paper, an image on a computer. It's obviously made up by an aspect of electronics, but our mind doesn't see that. It's a shorthand to make stuff easy and convenient for our perceptions to take that in and use that in an applicable world that we want to try to operate in. But that's also been the case in general for other aspects of perception, visual perception. It's an old philosophical problem. So obviously when you look at an apple or you see another human, what you're really seeing in the language of physics is obviously a bundle of particles, energy and light, but that's not how you perceive it to yourself physically, obviously. So it is a shorthand, but this has been going on for other aspects of evolution and philosophy. With that, I appreciate that then causes a problem, because if we see the world through this shorthand, we get this problem with neurons, because neurons themselves could be a shorthand for something else, as you alluded to there. But just because it's a shorthand for something else, it doesn't necessarily follow that there could be another aspect of objective matter that can produce consciousness. So on the one hand, I do appreciate how if everything's a shorthand for reality, then are these neurons really there? Okay, the neurons could be a shorthand for something else that could also be matter, explaining mind. How do you address and resolve some of these issues?
So the theorem makes it clear that if evolution by natural selection is how our perceptual systems evolved, then even space-time itself is not objective reality. That is just our desktop. And that means that in terms of understanding objective reality at its fundamental levels, space-time is doomed. Clean prediction. Physics will have to let go of space-time completely in their fundamental theories of the nature of reality.
But that's also an issue that's been, for example, obviously Kantian philosophy, in terms of we can't know things directly outside of time and space because we're limited by time and space, is an old argument in philosophy. And also time and space, even though it's got a lot of predictive and explanatory power, it still only exists within the mathematical equations of from Newton to Einstein. So I would agree with you there that time and space literally is a framework that humans use. It's clearly limited for a variety of reasons, but continue, Donald.
Yes, no, I agree with you, what you said there. Differing from Kant, though, I think that even though I'm saying that space and time aren't the nature of objective reality, I disagree with Kant, at least some exegesis of Kant, where they say that he claims that you can't know the noumena or say anything about the noumena. And as a scientist, of course, I would have to disagree and say that we have to give it the good old college try. And as a working hypothesis, we'll assume that even though I reject space-time, which has been our long-standing framework for reality, that it's still within our powers to come up with mathematically precise theories of hypotheses about what the ultimate nature of reality might be that are entirely non-physical, in the sense that up until now, physics has been about what happens in space and time. So when I'm saying that we need a theory of ultimate reality that doesn't occur in space and time, but that gives rise, almost as an emergent property perhaps, space and time, then I'm saying we need to have a mathematically precise theory of this ultimate reality, with one boundary condition on that theory being that it gives back as an emergent property space-time physics, quantum mechanics, general relativity, and ultimately a theory of quantum gravity, where these things are viewed not as fundamental, but as emergent from a theory that's much more fundamental. The idea being, again, that space-time is in the language of our sensory systems that were evolved to keep us alive and evolved to hide the truth. But we still, that's the only empirical data that we can have. Evolution shaped us with senses that only allow us to get empirical data in that format. So as scientists, we're required by evolution to do experiments that project whatever reality is back into our interface, and that's where we can test our theories of reality. So we can still do the normal scientific hypothesis testing where we create theories, and we recognize that one theory, namely that space-time is fundamental, that theory is false. We've loved it. We liked it like we liked flat Earth and geocentric universe. It's very, very dear to us. And all three of them have to go. Flat Earth, geocentric, and now space-time itself has to go. They had a nice ride and they're false. But that doesn't stop science. We can continue to try to come up with a theory of reality as it is that's mathematically precise. And that's where I've gone with the theory of conscious agents. And again, I'm probably wrong, but what I'm trying to say is, what is the ultimate nature of reality and can we be precise about it? It's not space and time, so that's a game changer. I cannot let go of the idea of conscious experiences without pretty much letting go of everything, as I said earlier. If I'm wrong about conscious experiences, I'm wrong about pretty much everything. It's time to have a beer and just relax. It's game over. So what I'm trying to do as a scientist then is to say, let's get a mathematical model of consciousness on its own terms, not as an emergent property from brain activity. If you look at most quote-unquote theories of consciousness, they're really theories of brain activity or computer programs, you know, functionalism. And then you say consciousness is this activity of the brain or this structure or whatever it might be, you know, microtubules or integrated information or whatever it might be, global workspace or global neuronal workspace. But so consciousness is really not addressed on its own terms as a fundamental mathematical structure. It's the brain or processes of the brain that are addressed, and then consciousness is supposed to pop out. So my orientation is entirely different. I'm saying we focus on consciousness on its own terms. What do we mean by experience, decision, and action? What is the right mathematical structure? Can we put down a mathematical structure that is perhaps as simple as like the Turing machine was, and yet have the power in the field of consciousness studies that the Turing machine had in the field of, you know, computation? And so I'm proposing then, again, it's a bold hypothesis, but at least it's precise, that the ultimate nature of reality is entirely conscious agents and their interactions. So it's a clean hypothesis. Consciousness is fundamental with this rigorous mathematical structure of conscious agents. And then the burden on me is to show that I can get all of space-time physics, including quantum mechanics and general relativity, and then, you know, ultimately even quantum gravity, to come out of this theory of conscious agents and their interactions as an emergent property, as seen through an interface of certain agents.
Whilst I agree and I fully appreciate the point that time and space is something that we have constructed, or at least evolution has constructed for us as a shorthand for the interpretation of reality, I would agree with you completely there for the aspects of, obviously, we're limited by time and space. I'm not necessarily sold on why that would be a problem for how we use neurons as a shorthand for presenting consciousness to us, but I'm assuming that you're also saying that this idea of the neuron in the brain is obviously also part of this constructed reality, just as time and space. That would essentially be your argument.
That's exactly right. So if space-time is doomed as part of the ultimate nature of reality, then all of its contents are also doomed.
And that includes, obviously, a materialistic brain.
Absolutely.
Okay, that's completely fine. And that makes sense internally in terms of logical structure. The aspect that you're bringing out of that, though, is obviously how you're putting a preeminence importance on the role of mathematics here. So for you and your mathematical modeling, how are you seeing mathematics? Because someone might then also lump mathematics in with time and space and a perception of the material world. Obviously, we're now getting into idealist arguments in philosophy, but are you saying that mathematics is separate from all these other divisions, almost in a Platonic abstract realm, because you're open to the charge that, well, you might as well throw mathematics into the bin along with,
yes,
time and space and the material universe at a reductive level, but you're saying that mathematics also has this special role. So how does mathematics play in this? Is it also fundamental like consciousness, or is it a tool for shorthand? And if it's a shorthand, and it's also got the problems that time and space have?
Great question, and it gets to the heart of the matter. So first, the work on evolution by natural selection that shows that our perceptual systems evolved to hide the truth. So if they evolved by natural selection to hide reality as it is, the question would also then naturally arise, did our mathematical abilities, does natural selection also entail that our mathematical abilities are also a fiction? I mean, our perceptions are a fiction, a useful fiction, but a fiction. Does natural selection, does the same argument that I gave just also show that mathematics and logic are a fiction? Because if that's the case, then I've shot myself in the foot, right? That I'm in a logical bind. I've used the logic of the theory of evolution to show that logic is a fiction. And so it's game over if that's the case. So that was, of course, a very interesting question to me, and I've been looking into it, and it turns out that we have to be very, very careful. When we look at evolution by natural selection, we have to look at each cognitive capacity one by one and see what selection pressures will do to that cognitive capacity. We cannot paint with a broad brush. And it turns out that logic and mathematics are very, very different than perception, because there are selection pressures for us to get fitness payoffs correct. So two apples give me roughly twice the payoffs of one apple. And so there are selection pressures for at least elementary correctness with mathematical computations, because we need them to get the fitness correct. And then also in our social, we're a social species, and it turns out an elementary logic is necessary to deal with cooperation and detection of cheaters. If we all cooperate, everything's fine. But if we're cooperating, I'm sharing what I got in the hunt today with you, but then it turns out that you never share with me and that you're a lazy bum. Well, I mean, I actually need to have some ability to have a logic about, if I do this for you, then I expect you to do this for me, and so forth. There's elementary logic that comes out from our social interactions. And also as a species that communicates with language, Dan Sperber and Hugo Mercier have shown that it looks like we have some elementary logic ability that's used to argue for our point of view, not for the truth, but as a persuasive tool. And so our ability with logic is at its best when we're arguing. So what we have from an evolutionary point of view, on the one hand, perception, the selection pressures are clear. They're against truth. But for math and logic, the selection pressures are not against truth. They're not for genius, by the way. I'm not saying that there are selection pressures for all of us to be von Neumanns. That's certainly not the case. But there are selection pressures for us to be able to, deal with elementary fitness payoffs and social interactions in a mathematically and logically accurate way. And then every once in a while, the genes that convey that ability, you win the lottery and you get a von Neumann coming out of the mix. So math is, from that point of view, very, very different from perception. Now, in terms of the ontological status, you asked about the Platonic status. That raises another interesting question. When I look at consciousness itself and I write down a mathematical theory of it, I'm effectively postulating that the ultimate nature of reality has a structure. And I'm proposing what that structure is. And so that mathematical structure is, according to this hypothesis, and again, I could be wrong, but at least it's a clean hypothesis, that this mathematical structure is part of the essence of the ultimate nature of reality that I'm calling conscious agents. So just to summarize what I've said, there's two parts to the answer. One is that the selection pressures don't drive good logic and math to extinction. And second, that I'm proposing, fallibly, perhaps incorrectly, but I'm proposing that when I say consciousness is fundamental, this mathematical structure is part of what that means. And so the mathematics is fundamental. So when we say, as scientists, we're always looking for the theory of everything, the ultimate theory, the basic theory. And maybe we're wrong to look for it, but that's what we're doing. And so my proposal is that mathematics is an aspect of that ultimate theory. And so in that sense, an aspect of ultimate reality.
So on the one hand, you've got the tools of perception that we've inherited throughout evolution that basically hide aspects of reality from us because they perform an efficiency function, essentially, and that includes time and space. On the other hand, you've got other aspects such as mathematics, reason and logic. Many would argue that the structure of logic is universal in certain respects, and you've also highlighted situations where reason and logic might be more applicable at a universal level because they can help problem solve and help solutions in social interactions. So that doesn't need to be eroded and doesn't have to hide any kind of the truth. Within that, because you're also taking evolution as part of that, obviously you say perception is what's the problem with error, and that includes time and space, but obviously you're adhering to elements of evolution. But then from that perspective, why is it specifically, and I know you've given various reasons and we'll talk about more about your mathematical model in a second, but because you seem to adhere to the actual objective reality of evolution itself, and evolution to a certain extent can at least provide a theoretical framework of why animals have evolved to have consciousness, couldn't we just take that from the field of evolutionary psychology? If you're going to say that evolution serves a purpose and has a driving force behind life, then we can get consciousness out of that. But you're really not happy with that because of the problems just in general of getting consciousness out of a material brain.
Right. So let me pose a problem that's I think the heart of your question, and someone could argue against me on, and that is to say, look, Hoffman, you used the theory of evolution by natural selection to show that space-time and physical objects aren't part of reality because their perceptions are incorrect. And that means that DNA doesn't exist unperceived. And that means you've now destroyed the theory of evolution that you used to boot up your whole theory. So you've shot yourself in the foot again, right? You've gotten rid of DNA and cells and organisms, any things in space and time. You've already got, but those were assumed in evolution by natural selection. And so you've used the theory to disprove the theory. So once again, you're caught in a logical foot shooting exercise.
I wouldn't necessarily say that. I would just say that you're taking some elements of evolution and putting them on the table and getting rid of other elements of evolution.
Okay.
And so the perceptual aspect of it, I mean, I have no problem with time and space being constructed. But then on the other hand, you believe in the theory of evolution because you're saying how it's evolved to have us perceive stuff in a limited way. So it's like a chop and mix in both areas. How do you marry the two? So I'm not saying that you're saying that DNA doesn't exist. Clearly, I think you are saying, but you're saying that evolution exists, but then some of the contents and products of evolution don't exist. Is there a bit of a tension here?
No, I agree with you. So the idea is I used the heart of evolution by natural selection, what Dawkins and Dennett call universal Darwinism. And it's an algorithm. Whenever you have variation, selection, and retention, then you have evolution by natural selection. And, you know, they're very, you know, famous for talking about evolving so-called memes, ideas, tunes, and so forth that are catchy, that spread throughout the population, again, through variation, selection, and retention. And so the idea then is that when I used evolutionary game theory, I was using the heart of evolution, the algorithm of evolution, namely this universal Darwinism. And when you use that, this is actually the nice thing about science, the power of science. I take the scientific theory of evolution by natural selection, use its algorithmic core, and then prove that the rest of it is unnecessary. The assumption of organisms and DNA and space and time is completely unnecessary. Now, this puts a new burden on me, though. If I'm letting go of space and time, and I've got this theory of reality being just conscious agents in their interactions, then one very strong constraint on that theory is that dynamics of conscious agents, when I project it back into the space-time interface of Homo sapiens, I better get back evolution by natural selection. I better get back Darwin. If I don't do that, then I'm wrong. So what happens is really interesting here. I start off with Darwinian evolution, take its algorithmic core, show that the rest of Darwinian evolution is not essential, but then that forces me to come up with a new theory about what is essential, and a boundary condition on that new theory of what's essential, which I'm taking to be consciousness, is that when I project that new theory back into the space-time interface of Homo sapiens, I better get back the full theory of Darwin, not just the algorithmic core.
At least you admit how you can be chopping and changing aspects of evolution, but at least you defend why you have to do that, which is fine, because obviously you're trying to get evolution out of reality whilst also positing the dangers of evolution being in reality, because they can lead to false perceptions. So you're having to deal with a double-edged sword, but at least you balance it reasonably well. You admit there could be problems in there, but I think the way you're trying to expand on it is quite interesting. So that's fair enough. Now, with that, which comes the really fascinating part, I know you've talked a bit already about how you can model consciousness mathematically, and I saw in one of your lectures how you show the demonstration of the cube and you basically get probability like a wave function, which is very interesting. And essentially your work is saying that you're reversing everything. You're saying that consciousness doesn't come out of a physical universe. You're saying the physical universe comes out of consciousness, which is very interesting itself. But what are some of the practical applications for this and the practical causal mechanisms for this? How is it that first consciousness is innate, irreducible and fundamental, and then how does it create the physical universe? So I know you're saying that the same equations that can be applied to consciousness can also get time and space and quantum gravity out of it, but practically how is it that first of all we have consciousness as being fundamental and then a physical universe comes out of that? Are you also collapsing awareness as being simultaneous with consciousness? How does it work from the bottom up?
So the example of the Necker cube is a good example to make the ideas clear. It's a simple line drawing that anybody can do, just a few lines on a piece of paper that when you look at those lines, it looks like a cube. It pops out of the paper in 3D as a cube, and it can flip. Probably everybody that's ever had a psychology class has seen the Necker cube. And so you can see two different cubes, one with a corner, you know, call it A, corner A in front, and then sometimes it flips and the what was the back corner B pops up to the front. And so when you look at it, you'll either see cube A, you know, with the corner A in front, or cube B, the cube with corner B in front. And if, you know, a bunch of people are looking at the same piece of paper and you ask, what cube do you see? Half of the people will roughly say, I see cube A, and half will say, I see cube B. And it depends on which one you happen to perceive at that point. But if I ask you, what cube exists in objective reality when you don't look at the paper? What is the nature of the, you know, what is the cube? Is it cube A or cube B when you don't look? The first answer, of course, is to say, well, there is no cube. It's, you know, that I construct the cube when I look at the piece of paper, so there is no correct answer to that, right? It's not cube A that exists or cube B that exists when no one looks, because those cubes are entirely the construction of my conscious experience. So I think that is the right response. But suppose I'm, you know, a hard nose, and I say, I insist that you give me a description of reality when you're not looking at that paper in terms of the language of cube A or cube B. I insist that you describe reality in those predicates, even when you're, you know, so that's what I want you to do. Well, then if you force me to do that, I'm going to have to write down that I'll say, well, it's probability, say a half that I'm going to see cube A plus a half that I'll see cube B. So the state of the world is not a definite state because I don't know what I'm going to see. So I write down a mathematical structure that we call a superposition, because you forced me to use the wrong predicates to describe reality. And that's what happens in quantum mechanics. When we describe the state of the world in quantum mechanics, we're forced to use quantum states that are called superpositions because we're using the wrong predicates. So what I'm saying is that when we actually, every time we use superpositions in quantum mechanics, it's the mathematics is telling us you're using the wrong language. It's the wrong language for describing reality. You're forcing the description that you have, that evolution gave to you, the predicates that evolution gave to you, as the only language that you're going to use to describe reality. And in that case, you're going to have to use a superposition. The next part, though, is quite interesting. My point of view here is very similar to a framework in quantum mechanics developed by Christopher Fuchs called cubism. And in cubism, the idea is that the quantum state is not a statement about the objective reality independent of the observer. It's instead the degrees of belief that the observer has about what the observer will see if the observer does certain actions. So it's the consequences for me of actions that I might take in this situation. So the quantum state is not an objective state of reality. It's a subjective degree of belief about the outcomes of experiments that you could take. And from that point of view, that's entire. Now, of course, I'm not saying that Chris endorses my general theory of consciousness. I'm not saying that at all. I mean, I'm on good terms with Chris, and we've talked, but I would not want to say that he's endorsing my theory at all. But I do like his idea that the wave function is subjective degrees of belief, not objective reality. That fits perfectly with the point of view that I'm taking. So when going back to the Necker cube example, if I'm using that superposition that, you know, it's half probability of seeing cube A when I look, half a probability of seeing cube B, that's the state of the world when I'm not looking. Now I go look, and all of a sudden I see, say, cube A. Well, I no longer need to describe the state of the world by that superposition because I'm now seeing cube A. So that is now my state of the world. So we get what we call the collapse. So the reason why there was something to collapse in the first place was because the language of superposition is simply telling us that we had the wrong description in the first place.
My general question was, how is it that you build it from the bottom up? So how is it that you get the physical world from consciousness? And you're essentially saying that because of the measurement problem, because in quantum physics a particle can be in the same place at twice, it's not until an observer actually pinpoints on the particle that it actually becomes measured and becomes objective. Without that perception, there isn't an objective reality. So that's how you're saying how consciousness builds the physical universe.
Absolutely. That space and time themselves are our construction, and that particles are our construction. And so there's a clean prediction of this. Very, very strong predictions, a couple. One is that no particle has any definite value of any dynamical physical property when it's not observed. No position, momentum, spin. Those do not exist. Clean prediction. Second, no physical object in space and time has any causal powers. Causality in space and time is only a fiction. And that last one is the problem with neural models of consciousness. They assume that neurons have causal powers, and they don't. So that gets to the heart of the matter here. That's the whole odyssey I've been here, looking at evolution by natural selection and the interface theory and consciousness, gets to that one point. Causality in space and time is a fiction. Neurons have no causal power. So to put it very boldly, neurons cause none of my experiences and none of my behaviors. Just that simple. That sounds radical, but I've given the logic behind it. And that's the bitter pill that we have to swallow if we're going to make progress on consciousness.
To me, that's not too shocking in the light of someone like David Hume and Kant. Obviously, time and space are part of the mental constructs of the world that we project onto the world. And that also goes into the issue of causality itself. Obviously, Hume said that causation doesn't really exist. It's just conjectures between observations, which is fine. And I don't really have a problem arguing with that. That's fine. I mean, many things are constructs of the mind. And I would say that causation is a mental map that we scheme onto the world. Obviously, it's got many powerful tools that we can use in the world, but essentially causality isn't intrinsic or objective in itself, and it's something that we project onto the world, and many philosophers of science have argued this point as well. So no dispute for me there. In terms of,
can I say one thing on that?
Of course.
I absolutely agree with you. Many philosophers have been quite aware of this, but most scientists that are looking at the mind-body problem, this is huge news. And if you look at 99% of the models that are proposed, they all assume that neural activity has causal consequences. For example, Tononi, in his integrated information theory, he identifies conscious experiences with the causal structure of neural computations, or of any physical computation, but, you know, so he doesn't require just neurons, but any physical system that has a computational structure with certain properties, the integrated, you know, information properties of the causal structure, then he identifies consciousness with that. But the point is, there are no causal structures in space-time. There's nothing for him to identify. So when you take this radical, for the scientist radical, but, you know, not for him, the realization that causation in space and time is fiction, then it wipes out the foundation of the most widely known theory of consciousness among scientists today, namely Tononi's, which assumes causation in space and time as the foundation.
And there's different ways to pull that kind of framework apart. So obviously a lot of it has to do with the history of philosophy of science and what it is that scientists do. So from a pragmatic model, elements such as reality, realism, instruments for measurement, causal powers and predictive models serve their purpose. Obviously, what is it that causes the plane to fly and keep it in the air? We can model that.
Yes.
Many philosophers such as Nancy Cartwright, that's in between these two, would say that. But essentially, at an ontological level, what classic philosophers have always said is that, yes, causality, prediction, explanation have pragmatic functions. And this is obviously something that James Dewey, also the pragmatist, would have said a few centuries later. But in terms of an objective, intrinsic, ontological sense, we can't say there's anything causing anything outside the world. And that's obviously a problem that then befalls someone like Tononi. So on the one hand, yes, they're useful and explanatory in terms of having a model. But at the same time and simultaneously, models are obviously projects from the human mind. And obviously, you can't really ever know that causality is external to a scientific model or a scientific theory. So we're both, I think, agreed in that respect, and many philosophers would do as well. Obviously, a lot of practicing scientists don't like to get caught up in all this, what they would see as pointless humdrum stuff, because they're not really trying to prove causality in an external objective sense. They're just trying to use causality in ways that it can work.
Right.
But that's the whole debate in philosophy of science. But my fundamental question with all of this is, because you're reversing many models and many ways of looking at the world for the ways we've just discussed, and at the bottom of all of this is consciousness that is irreducible and fundamental, and everything comes from this consciousness. So how are we treating consciousness as a consequence of this? Is it something that's panpsychic? Is everywhere? Is consciousness God? And I don't mean in a literal religious or institutional sense, but is consciousness a primal phenomenon that itself isn't caused?
Yes. Yeah, so with regard to panpsychism, typically panpsychists are in some sense dualists, right? They will say things like, not all of them, but many of them, so I want to distinguish myself from that this point of view. They'll say that, for example, everything has consciousness. So an electron, for example, has spin, position, momentum, and, you know, some elementary unit of consciousness. And then you have, you know, what they call the combination problem, which is, okay, so I get two electrons together, or, you know, proton and neutron together, and, you know, the proton has some consciousness, the neutron has some consciousness. When you put them together to form a unified physical structure, what is the, you know, presumably, I mean, I have a conscious experience, and presumably it's not the same as the conscious experiences of all the atoms in my body. So how do all the conscious experience of all those atoms get together to generate the experience that I'm having right now of the room that I, you know, and the taste of chocolate or something like that? So I disagree with a fundamental assumption of that version of panpsychism. And the assumption is that protons and neutrons exist in space and time objectively, and also have consciousness. So that's the first part that I disagree with. I'm saying nothing in space and time exists objectively. So those versions of panpsychism, I have to just reject out of hand. Now, there's still something about the panpsychist idea that I want to retain. Namely, they do have the idea that there are elementary consciousnesses that can combine to create more elaborate consciousness and so forth. And I do retain that. And I do have a mathematical model of solving the combination problem. It's quite fascinating. You can actually combine conscious experiences and even conscious subjects. The mathematics shows you how to take two separate conscious subjects and create a new single unified subject, something that some philosophers had said is impossible. So I do have this point of view that consciousness is fundamental. Now, in terms of, you know, the implications for religion and God and so forth, it's quite interesting. On the one hand, having consciousness as opposed to space-time being fundamental is surely more congenial to certain religious traditions than the scientific, you know, the former scientific view of physical reality. You know, Eastern religions in particular might be, some of them might be more happy with this kind of idea. And I do get, you know, emails from various Eastern and also Western mystical traditions where people say this is what we've believed all along. I'm fine with that. I certainly wasn't trying to make any religious point here, but ultimately, I mean, I was really trying to solve the problem of consciousness per se, and you know, I was forced, you know, almost kicking and screaming to let go of space and time, and then to postulate that consciousness is fundamental. But now that I'm there, and I want to be a rigorous scientist, I recognize that this framework does allow the potential for, you know, a scientific spirituality, a kind of, you know, understanding of human desires and aspirations and consciousness, but getting rid of the dogmatism that has you know, really dogged religion for millennia, right? They have scriptures that are, you know, sacred and can't be questioned, whereas in a scientific point of view, everything is open to question, everything is open to debate. There are no authorities, there are no sacred scriptures. Scriptures are fine for inspiration, but so is a glass of beer. And so I think that there is the potential for a rapprochement between science and religion, but both sides are going to have to give up something that they might not want to give up. On the science side, is giving up space-time. And I think that science will eventually be forced to give up space-time as fundamental. I mean, people like, you know, physicists like Nima Arkani Hamed are already giving lectures, right? I mean, David Gross has said, you know, that string theory makes it clear that space-time is doomed. There are a number of you know, very, very serious physicists who already understand that the game is over for space-time. So I think the rest of physics will come along in a few decades. You know, these pioneers already understand it. On the religious side, I mean, they're going to have to give up their dogmatism. I mean, dogmatism just gets in the way of understanding. And so, but if we can have the rigorous method of science and this new ontology in which consciousness is fundamental, and then we stick with the rigor, we may eventually become able to develop a science of spirituality that could really help illuminate the human condition and maybe help to ameliorate it. I mean, I have hopes there. Now, you know, the question of what is God? I mean, I don't know. I think the term is not well defined, so it's hard to say anything intelligent about it. But I would say this: suppose that when I look at the theory of conscious agents that I've been working on, there is an most elementary conscious agent. It's an agent that can have effectively only one bit of perception, and one bit of action. Right? So there is a bottom, a logical bottom to this hierarchy of conscious agents. What happens, and I can combine them, I can take two one-bit agents and combine them into a two-bit agent and so forth. And the question is, what's the maximum? Is there a single global maximum or not? If there is a single global maximum, that would be very interesting. If there's one biggest conscious agent, I doubt it, actually. I really doubt that that's the case. But if it were the case, then you could call that God. But if it's more likely that there are countless local maxima, of this conscious agent combination thing. So maybe there's an infinite number of those, and maybe that's God, you know. So again, what's nice about this is when I look at the religious literature, and you know, I respect the religious practices, and so I have nothing bad to say about that, but as a scientific enterprise, they've been spinning in the same circles intellectually for thousands of years. It's, you know, the only way to actually get out of a war of words and just rehashing old, you know, formulations is to make things mathematically precise, because then you can be surprised. The mathematics is always smarter than the person who writes it down. When Einstein wrote down the equation of general relativity, he had no idea that it meant, that it implied the existence of black holes and that the universe was not static. He had no idea. Surprised him that it implied black holes, and I think it was a stunner for him. And that's the power of mathematics, and I think it will be in spirituality. We'll finally get it. We've had spiritual ideas for thousands of years. They've always been in normal everyday language. When we translate it into mathematics, we have finally the chance to be surprised and to make progress. And so I'm hoping that there will be a scientific spirituality, but I think that, you know, it will be a shock. It will be something entirely new. It will not be dogmatic, and it will not be in physical space-time. So there'll be a lot for a lot of people to, you know, come to terms with.
Okay, thanks for all of that, Donald. Very, very interesting points. I wasn't really pressing the issue so much of an existential god. I was just, essentially, when you're talking, is a consciousness being irreducible, primary, and fundamental? Is it always been there, infinite regress into the past, if consciousness is just what exists at a de facto level?
Yes. That's a profound question as well. And the answer that I would have is that the question itself is interesting because it is asking about something in time. Has consciousness always existed? And so my answer is that time and space themselves are constructs of consciousness. And so that the answer has to be that in some sense it's always existed because it was there, you know, here now we do come up against the limits of human conceptions, right? Because I'm going to have to say consciousness was there before time, right? Well, I'm already using the notion of time when I say before. So we are limited in what we can say. But the idea is that consciousness is fundamental. Space and time are derivatives. So in that sense, yes, consciousness was there before time.
I also think there's certain, the limits of human conceptualization and the way we think about certain problems is obviously illuminating to the deeper issues of how we think. So clearly, we're limited by time and space, so we think in time and space, and you're saying it's obviously a construct of consciousness in itself. I also think there's certain metaphysical issues at the heart of this. So you're not saying that consciousness itself causes time and space, but consciousness constructs time and space, which is different.
That's right.
But you're also going to have metaphysical problems with that in general, as in how can a construct of time and space come out of something that has no time and space? So this is an old religious and philosophical issue as well, but it's interesting to note that it's how can something that's causeless cause something, which is a dilemma that we could be here with all day.
There is one objection that I think I should address, because I think it's perhaps the most psychologically compelling objection that people have to the point of view that I'm proposing about the interface theory. And the objection goes like this: you know, Hoffman, if you think that train coming down the tracks at 200 miles an hour is just an icon on the desktop of your interface, why don't you step in front of it? And after you're dead and your theory with you, we'll know that that train was real, that it's part of an objective reality, and it's not just merely an icon of your conscious experiences. And my reply is that I wouldn't step in front of that train for the same reason I wouldn't carelessly drag an icon from, on my desktop to the trash can. Not because I take the icon literally. The file isn't blue, it's not rectangular, but I do take it seriously. If I drag that icon to the trash can, I could lose weeks or years of work. And so the icons are there to be taken seriously. And evolution, shaped us with icons like snakes and trains that are there for, our survival. We better take them seriously. I mean, that's why evolution shaped us with those icons. They're there about fitness. They're there to keep us alive long enough to reproduce. We better take them seriously. But we then make the leap and say, because I must take these things seriously, I have to also take them literally. And that's a logical error. But it's a very compelling psychological mistake that we make. And so I just wanted to flush that one out, because I think a lot of people would hear the interview so far and go, well, yeah, fun stuff, but there's this devastating argument that wipes out the whole conversation. So I just want to say that it's a logical error to think that because we have to take our perceptions seriously, that we have to take them literally.
I don't think that's an issue in terms of your framework. So obviously a shorthand is there to inform you in a way that's going to mold and affect your thinking and your behavior. It doesn't have to be correct, but it serves a purpose. So obviously we've already discussed how this works in the mating game. I wouldn't say that because of Donald Hoffman's theory that I'm going to jump in front of a train. No, if I'm getting in a hot bath and my sensations of my body are telling me that this bath is extremely hot, I'm not then going to say, oh, wait a minute, this is all in my head, it's not real. It's a shorthand. It's telling my sensations in my brain and my nervous system that this water is too hot, so you better start doing something about it. You don't need to know why the water's hot or what temperature it is specifically.
That's right.
It's a shorthand for that. So I assume some people make that argument, but you're not saying that you're disregarding all the elements in reality. You're just saying it's about how we perceive them and how we use them internally as a cognitive system.
Yes.
With that in mind, how are you in terms of being a realist? Because on the one hand, you are a realist objectively, but on the other hand, you're also not. So you're not disputing that tables and chairs are there. You're not disputing that trains are going there. Objective reality can be physically measured. You're just saying that it all comes out of consciousness.
That's right. So I call the point of view that I'm taking conscious realism. Because I, as you say, I am a realist. I think that consciousness is real. My experiences are real. I mean, for example, if I have a headache, it's not publicly observable. You can't see my headache. But if you said, because I can't see your headache, it's not real, I might be very cross with you, right? it's a real experience. So we often use the word real to say that it exists independent of observation. And my headache doesn't exist in some sense independent of my observation. It is my experience, and so it is my observation. So I do take conscious experiences, and therefore my conscious experience, philosophers would say, as of a train or as of an apple, as real experiences. So I am a realist in that sense, and I'm not an anti-realist. When I let go of space and time and physical objects as the objective reality, some people might say, "Oh, so Hoffman is an anti-realist or something like that." And I'm very much a realist. I'm also quite aware that I could be wrong. That it's quite possible that so when I say I'm a realist, I'm not just a functionalist. I'm a functionalist about things in space and time. I'm just saying that they're there to keep us alive. But as a scientist, I'm a realist about this theory of conscious agents. And again, I may be wrong, but that's the approach I'm taking, and I'd be happy to have someone show that that's incorrect. I'd like to learn if it is incorrect. But I'm proposing that, in fact, consciousness is fundamental. That is the nature of reality. That's a realist thesis, and that's why I call it conscious realism.
Your theory also, it's obviously trying to marry a lot of concepts together and also disentangle a lot of concepts together. Your theory is quite peculiar in the sense that it doesn't refute an aspect of reality or even external physical objects of the mind. You're just saying it's just conscious realism that underpins it all. So simultaneously, your model is realist whilst also being idealist, which is quite odd.
Yes.
But we're not talking about philosophy of logic here. In general, you're just proposing a framework of how our consciousness constructs the world around us, and you're essentially saying that it's fundamental, which is fine.
That's right, and I agree with your point that it's idealist and yet realist, and that's why I decided I needed a new term, because the closest philosophical category was idealism, but that immediately brings up connotations of anti-realism for many people, and so I needed to counter that by just coining my own new philosophical category that I call conscious realism.
I see how it solves the problem. Obviously, there'll be loads of people that still say, well, by definition, that's also idealist, but you're trying to marry the external physical world to it, which isn't the world's easiest job to do. So it's doing well. I think personally for me, having obviously a lot of extensive experience in philosophy of science and philosophy in general, I think your work, the most novel bit about it, I mean, like we've already discussed, I mean, this idea of consciousness being irreducible fundamental has been around in different cultures and traditions for a long time. You're not by far the only neuroscientist that thinks this. I believe Christopher Cook at Caltech also has a version similar to this. Stuart Hammer of Roger Penrose. There's many thinkers that think that consciousness is primordial and irreducible. I think the best thing about your novel theory is the way that at least you're trying to mathematically model consciousness, which is a starting point. That if you're going to try and study something scientifically like we have done with space-time, then you might as well start trying to assign numbers to a conscious experience. So for me personally, that's the best takeaway from your work.
Yes, I agree. It's just, let's do a mathematical model of consciousness on its own terms. Absolutely. I would just say one thing about the theory of Hameroff and Penrose, that they do assume that space-time and physical objects are real, and that microtubules exist unperceived, and that consciousness emerges from collapses of states of the microtubules. And so they're very, very different from the point of view that I take when I say that consciousness is fundamental. Because they're taking physics really and space-time and microtubules is fundamental, and somehow the collapse of the states of the microtubules gives rise to conscious experiences. So that I would just distinguish my view from theirs. They're still fundamentally physicalists that are looking for consciousness to emerge from collapses of microtubules, and I'm not. I'm saying that the microtubules themselves are merely icons in the desktop.
That's a good point when you put it like that. I hadn't actually looked at it that way. No, it's actually reversed. It's actually consciousness coming out of quantum physics. You're right in that respect. I've spoken to Stuart Hameroff a few times about this, and I always get the impression that he's always trying to reduce consciousness to something innate in itself. But having spoken to other thinkers in this area, they're just saying that essentially they don't want to explain a consciousness coming out of the material brain per se. They're trying to reduce it to the quantum physics level, but as you're saying, other people are saying that it's still physicalist in some respect.
Absolutely, and the same thing with Christoph Koch. I mean, Christoph and I go back for many years, and I'm, you know, friends and so forth. I like him personally, but he's, you know, he's really with integrated information theory, and so he's assuming with Tononi that neural activity exists subjectively and has causal structure, and that causal structure is, or gives rise to, right, they actually identify, so they say it is conscious experience. So he's actually a physicalist as having consciousness emerge, and again, in that sense, I'm very, very different from that point of view. I'm saying quite the opposite. Consciousness alone exists as fundamental, and space-time emerges from it as merely descriptions of interfaces.
Oh, that's interesting, because I saw an interview with Christopher Koch, and he was saying, obviously you would know much more than me in this area, but in what sense does he think that consciousness is irreducible as well? And he also says that brain alone can't explain mind. So what context does he mean that in?
Well, when he would say the brain alone can't explain mind, it would be that these causal computational structures need not be in brains. They could be any causal computational structure. But what he's not going to let go of is space and time and physics. He's going to have some computational structure. And I actually put this question to Tononi himself at FQXI conference on in Banff just a couple months ago. And I asked him flat out, would it be possible for the universe to exist without any of these causal integrated computations going on, and therefore no consciousness? Because I wanted to, I mean, that's the question to ask him, to find out if consciousness is fundamental or not. And he admitted the possibility that the universe could exist without those causal computational structures, and therefore without consciousness. So in that sense, I got it from Tononi himself that consciousness is not fundamental.
A lot of this gets a bit murky and blurred into one, because obviously a lot of the time when you think that if someone necessarily says that consciousness can't be explained solely by the brain, then you might think that they're trying to say that it's consciousness kind of precludes the brain, but you're saying they're still having it within the conception of causation, and you want to do away with causation itself.
Exactly.
What are you working on your horizon in terms of what papers have you got coming out in this area, or any forthcoming books at all?
I do have a book that is under contract to be delivered at the end of July, so it should come out by the end of this year. It'll be published by Norton. Right now, my title, I haven't asked Amanda Gefter yet, but I might borrow the title from her Atlantic interview that she did with me, The Case Against Reality. I think that's a good title for the book, and it's going to describe the interface theory of perception and motivate it by the problem of consciousness, and then have just one chapter about this conscious agent theory. I think I'm going to have to do another book later on just entirely about conscious agents and how I view consciousness. But this new book that'll come out perhaps by the end of the year will be primarily on the interface theory and caching it out and explaining it.